Tech of Sports, episode 16 for June 27th, 2012. Former ATP tennis pro Jeff Salzenstein. This week on this Tech of Sports, Jeff Salzenstein. Netcast Studio mobile apps are a great way to receive your content for your smart devices. There's an app for both iOS and Android. And don't forget the Stitcher Radio app for all iOS devices. Stitcher Radio. It's an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone and tablet. Stitcher. It's smart radio for your smartphone. And the Tech of Sports is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network at techpodcast.com. If it's tech, it's here. The Tech of Sports is a production of Netcast Studio at netcaststudio.com. You can join us every Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific at netcaststudio.com/live, where you can join the chat room and listen to the show live. I'd like to welcome everybody tonight in the chat room, listening live and maybe listening on podcast, on tape. This week, we're going to talk about what's the big sporting event that's going on right now. And if you haven't noticed, ESPN really does cover more than the NBA and college football. And they are really going wall to wall this week and next week with their coverage of Wimbledon. And it's great for tennis fans all over the country. They get a full day of tennis, and they're doing a great job with that. And we're going to talk about Wimbledon, tennis tonight a little bit, and a little tennis technology and some other aspects of tennis with a great guest tonight, Jeff Salzenstein, a former ATP Top 100 tennis pro who's now in Denver, Colorado. He's not at Wimbledon right now, but he's joining us. And tennis has really been important to Jeff for a long time. And he was a successful junior player, and he won Stanford win two NCAA team titles. He was an All-American. He played for over 10 years on the Pro Tour, and he was ranked in the top 100 in the world. Among his wins, and make note of this, he has wins over David Nalbandian, Marty Fish, Dmitry Tursunov, Greg Ruzetsky. Not a bad little resume there, Jeff. And he has a great website, produces tennis videos now. He gives tips on techniques, footwork, strategy, nutrition, fitness. Focuses a lot on the mental aspects of the game, and makes tennis fun for everybody. And Jeff knows firsthand that tennis is a great sport, and you can play it your whole life. And we welcome you tonight, Jeff. How you doing?
Thank you very much for having me, Rick. Really appreciate being here and talking a little tennis tonight. It's going to be great.
Yeah, appreciate it, and welcome to the Tech of Sports. And I just, before we get started with the some formal questions here, I wanted to ask you. I just wanted to take you back maybe about 15 years, and let's talk about a second round match at the U.S. Open with Michael Chang, who was at number two in the world at that time, and you lost a pretty tight, close four setter to Michael, 6-4 in the fourth, I believe it was. And I just wanted to ask you something I've always wanted to ask you: when you walk away from that match, were you A, disappointed you lost the match? You were really close to one of the top five players in the world at that time, or were you B, happy with the way you played and felt good about yourself that you were able to compete at that level on a big stage in a big tournament? What were your feelings as that match ended and you were walking off the court or sitting there in the locker room after the match?
Well, Rick, you're taking me down memory lane. I appreciate you asking me that question. It's one of my fondest memories of playing on the tour. And what I remember about that match, a couple of things, and it's interesting, I get to share these stories with people now and really give people a backstory of what's really going on the Pro Tour and some of the mistakes I made and some of the things I could have done differently and some of the things I did well. In that particular case, I played in Arthur Ashe Stadium. It was the first year of Arthur Ashe Stadium. It was 25,000 people on a Friday night playing Michael Chang, and it was Labor Day weekend, so people still remember that match because I think they were probably in an Irish pub somewhere in New York City or Denver or somewhere in Hong Kong because for whatever reason, it was kind of a magnetic match, even though it was a four-setter. And what I remember, a couple things I remember about that match. Number one, I think I warmed up four times for that match because I thought, by golly, I'm going to get out on the court tonight in front of 25,000 people and millions of others on TV, and John McEnroe is going to be making the call, and I'm going to forget how to serve and forget how to hit a forehand. So I actually warmed up four times for that match. I think it was like 9, noon, 3, and 6. And my coach at the time, John Benson, I think we went to Central Park. We went out to the U.S. Open. So in looking back on that, you know, that tells me there's, in my case, I was a player who maybe didn't completely believe that I belonged on that stage where others really believed that I could. And fortunately, I was able to stay pretty close with Michael for the first set, and I was able to grab an early break, and I held throughout the rest of that set and won 6-4 in the first set. And as soon as I won that set point, I remember turning to my box and kind of smiling, giving a sly smile on national TV to my box. We had 20 people in there, my dad, my stepdad, my mom, great fraternity brother friends. I mean, just whoever could get a ticket that night was in that box. And I gave him a smile as if, okay, I'm here and that's enough. And that was the mistake that I made. I didn't walk out on the court believing that I could beat Michael Chang. Maybe I had the ability to do it, but I was just happy keeping it close. And of course, looking back on it, I would have done it very differently. The other thing that I noticed about that match was that Michael Chang was in supreme condition. You know, I was 1 year out of college and I was still essentially a college player still. And Michael Chang was a seasoned veteran, and he just had a much higher fitness level and a much higher ability to focus for a longer duration of time. So after that first set, I think my level really dropped off both physically and mentally, and it sure didn't help that I wasn't in there to stay the distance to find a way to win that match.
Yeah, it's interesting you say you still felt like a college player, where a lot of players, maybe he's an exception more than the rule, but I mean, John Isner came right out of college and he started doing pretty well pretty quickly. And I don't know if I call him a college player when he came out, but he's improved a lot since then even. I mean, leaps and bounds. It's amazing how much he's improved. But, I mean, players now I think are maturing maybe a little later. And maybe you were a little ahead of your time there because now a player coming out of college I think is pretty well prepared. Maybe not mentally, but prepared physically for a grind like that. Would you agree with that?
What I meant to say as a college player is that I still didn't really understand what it took to play 3 out of 5 sets, both physically and mentally. I had had tremendous success in that first year on the tour. I came out of the gate. I was 800 in the world when I turned pro, and I was 140 in the world 12 months later. And ironically enough, I did not sign with an agent after college. And after that Michael Chang match, I signed with IMG that week. And so that match, actually, people saw that match and said, this is a top 50 guy. He's going to be top 50 in the world. He has the ability. So I certainly had the ability and was playing at a pro level, but the mentality and the fitness level and the grind of playing 3 out of 5 sets, I didn't understand that at the time. And I didn't really know what it took to beat a guy like Michael Chang in 5 sets. I mean, I could have done it maybe in 2 out of 3, but certainly wasn't ready at that stage in 5. In terms of John Isner, you know, he came out of the gate early. He did really well in one of his first tour events in Washington, D.C. But here's a guy, two differences. Number one, he's 6'9" and he has a gigantic serve. So I had a huge serve, but certainly not the level that he has it at. But I really believe what sets John Isner apart from other college players and the reason he's excelling other than his size, two things. He has one of the best coaches in the world in his corner, Craig Boyton. And number two, he does have this unwavering belief that every time he steps on the court, he believes he can win. And, you know, I'm being very vulnerable with you tonight telling you, hey, I'm not sure I really believed. I got to a certain level. I got to the top 100. But there were the many situations where I was playing top 10 and top 20 guys where I was up a set and a break, serve for a set, serve for a match, and I didn't close the deal. So hopefully now that I'm a coach, I can transfer some of that information and help players believe more in themselves so that they can excel to the levels they deserve to excel at.
Yeah, you have great insight that you can pass on to juniors and to up and coming players that other people can't, and that's a good niche for you. With Wimbledon underway and the action on the last 3 days, of course, a little rain they had. How about some early impressions and talk a little bit about a little behind the scenes of Wimbledon there, especially maybe in a rain delay of what, how much nervous energy is going on in that locker room and what do you do to stay ready to get back on the court?
Sure. Well, the rain that's par for the course at Wimbledon. If it doesn't rain, that's an unusual year. So you always prepare for that. I played the main draw of Wimbledon 2 times in 1997 and I believe in 2003. I'd have to go back and look at the stats if it was 2003 or 2004. The years start to run together here. But in 1997, I qualified. It was my first year on the tour. It was 4 months before I played Michael Chang in that match, and I ended up playing a lucky loser, a guy who got in because someone pulled out, and I was up 2-1 on Tuesday, 2-2 in the fourth set, and it rained. And it rained Wednesday, and it rained Thursday, and it rained Friday. And we finished our first round match on Saturday of the first week, and I lost 9-7 in the fifth. So I actually had 4 days to think about how tight I was going to get the next time I came out on that Saturday, and I ended up pretty much choking and losing 9-7 in the fifth. So Wimbledon, not the fondest of memories as far as results go, but as far as the tradition, the prestige, the grounds, the feeling you get, the energy of the crowd, the fans, there's nothing like it. And, you know, I was listening actually to TV today, and Federer was saying, you know, once you win Wimbledon, you just feel different. You feel like a different player and a different person. And when you look at the top guys, it's par for the course. Federer, Djokovic, Nadal, they're on a collision course for the semifinals. I would be absolutely shocked if any of those three guys lost, which again is very unusual. When you look back 15, 20 years, there were many more upsets, but these guys are so dominant and they're so much better than everyone else and they're extremely focused, and all three of them are on this mission. We're truly in the golden age of tennis right now with these three guys, and so we should all really sit back, grab our popcorn, sit and watch these guys play in these semis, in these finals, because we don't know how many more years all three of them are going to be able to give us at the same time. So it's a very exciting time. And of course, with Maria Sharapova winning the French Open and really coming back to the level and actually pushing beyond what I think the level she played before her injuries, she's really raising up the women's game. I mean, without her, I think there's a big black hole as far as personalities and stars at the top of the game. We need more on the women's side, but thankfully we have Maria Sharapova, who is much more substance than style, even though she has tremendous style as well.
Yeah, well, I think we have, you know, you can put Serena in there, just that she doesn't play enough. So you can't count on her each and every week being out there. When she's out there, it's exciting, and she adds a lot to the game, but she just doesn't play enough. And I think when we talk about tennis now, and we talk about Wimbledon, you can't not talk about the rackets and the string technology that, you know, they talk about a lot on the air, and how much has that even changed now since you stopped playing the rackets and the strings? I mean, it's just it appears every 3 or 4 years it's a totally different game now almost.
Well, if you look at the top guys, they're primarily playing with the rackets they've been playing with for a long time. You know, Nadal's playing with the Babolat. Of course, Federer's playing with his Wilson, and you got Novak playing with the head racket. But what we don't know behind the scenes, or what I can share with everyone, is they're always tweaking their technology. It's kind of like Lance Armstrong on the bike. His goal was always to have, you know, be in the best condition, to have the best team around him, and to have the best bike. And the same holds true in tennis. These guys, they actually pay thousands of dollars they put guys on retainers. They actually travel to all the Grand Slams. They're stringing their 6 to 8 rackets a day. They're tweaking the specs on their rackets throughout the year, anything to give them a little edge. And I wouldn't be surprised if Novak Djokovic made a little tweak in his rackets 12 to 18 months ago when he went in on his run. These guys aren't going to talk about it. You're never going to hear about it, but I know that they are constantly tweaking their technology. And then, of course, with the string, you know, the Luxalon, the polyester type string that has become very popular on the tour, it's allowed players to decrease their tension, which means that they can hit with much more power. It also has allowed them to be able to hit more spin from more defensive positions. So a guy like Nadal can hit passing shots from 20 feet, 5 feet behind the baseline, and you couldn't do that in the 1980s when they were playing with gut. So technology has definitely made an incredible impact on the game of tennis, and if you don't evolve with the technology, you will perish. And so it's very important that you have the right racket. You even can play with a racket that's a little bit longer. Some guys play with longer rackets that are a half inch to get a little more stick. And then, of course, the string is probably the biggest change in the last 3 to 5 years, is the string has really changed and given players the ability to play defense and hit from incredible angles and incredibly defensive spots in the court.
Yeah, we had John Lyon on from Wilson Sports, the product manager, a few episodes back, and he said the same thing. The string is really, people talk about the rackets a lot, but the string is really what's changed and has really changed the game. And one thing that really hasn't changed in tennis is nutrition and fitness and needing to be fit. And we can't go an hour on the Tennis Channel without seeing your little bit when you're telling people to eat pumpkin seeds and trail mix. And I know that you've been a proponent of nutrition and fitness for a while. And while we're on the air here, let's give us a few more tips maybe that they didn't put on the Tennis Channel there on that little bit you're in.
Well, another backstory is when I was probably between the ages of 20, I'd say 28 and 32, my last 4 years on the tour, a lot of the American players, even some of the foreign players, they kind of saw me, you know, carrying around a powdered green drink. I was always drinking green drinks and protein shakes and goji berries, and they kind of gave me these weird looks, like, what the heck, what are you doing? I mean, what's your story? And now it's commonplace. A lot of these guys, I was talking to Amir Delek, who's been as high as 65 in the world, got to the fourth round, I think of the fourth round, maybe the third round of the Australian Open 1 year. He was telling me that, yeah, he's totally into this stuff. All these guys shop at Whole Foods now, and they're into organic. And then, of course, Novak Djokovic goes to a gluten-free diet a year and a half to 2 years ago and basically credits that for giving him the increased stamina and endurance. So I like to think I was a bit ahead of the times with how I was looking at nutrition, because I was always looking for that edge, and I was already 28, 29, 30. So I needed to keep up with these 20-year-olds. And now you're seeing Tommy Haas, Mike Russell, obviously Federer. All these guys are north of 30, and they're playing the best tennis of their lives. So certainly nutrition plays a huge component. As far as tips go, I mean, really, it's getting the processed foods out of the diet. I mean, I would think that would be the number one thing that a player or a coach can do, is really take a look at what you're eating every day. And the processed foods are really going to set you back. It's going to impact recovery. And, you know, little tricks like sea salt. You know, if you put a little sea salt, not regular salt, little sea salt on your food or in your drinks, that will replenish electrolytes. And, I mean, I can go on and on about all this different stuff, but really just trying to eat a whole foods diet, pretty simple. But it's harder to implement sometimes. And especially as a pro player, if you're traveling on the road, I often said that if I were James Blake or Roger Federer and I had a gazillion dollars and I was traveling around the world with a team, one of the first things that I would do is hire a full-time chef and probably bring him with me and have him actually cook in the hotel. Of course, if I could get that cook to get permission to do that. But it's tremendous value to be able to put the right fuel in your diet. And I think pro tennis players could play until their 40s if they were recovering on a daily basis with the right nutrition.
A good point and good observation. I know John Isner has been a proponent of coconut water. Where do you stand on that? And what's that done for some of the players that are using that?
I've got coconut water. I've got a case of it right behind me as we speak. So I take one or two of those a day if I need it, especially in the hot sun when I'm teaching outside. But that's another fabulous drink. A little bit high in sugar, so you might want to balance that with some protein and some fat, because you know it is straight sugar. But if you can drink it on the court, that's going to be fine. But off the court, you might want to balance it with some protein. But certainly, John Isner does swear by it, and it's helped him and many other players on the tour avoid cramping late in matches.
Yeah, it's going to be 104 here in Atlanta in the next couple of days. I may have to run out and get some.
Hot Atlanta.
Yeah, well, it's going to be brutal. And they have the U.S. Open playoff qualifying going on this weekend, so it's going to be a real test for some juniors and some college players trying to get a spot in the U.S. Open qualifying out there. So
yeah, we'll be hot.
Right now you're constantly working on and updating your site with a bunch of instructional videos. And I'll put a plug in for your site here. It's Jeff Salzenstein, tennis.com. And I'm really interested in it. I've done a lot of writing on juniors starting out and the new USTA 10 and under initiative for tennis. And just wanted to get your opinion on that and how, you know, the USTA is all in on this and they're trying it. And for someone that grew up, you know, not having that as, you know, as your guide to your development in tennis, how do you feel about what the USTA is doing with that?
Well, hopefully there aren't too many USTA officials watching this interview.
That's okay.
Tonight. Oh, well,
they know where I stand on it too. So
okay, well, I think it's one of the worst decisions that the USTA has made in the last 10 to 15 years, and I'll tell you why. Number one, when I was 5 years old, I played mini tennis. Last time I checked, there are service lines on a court, so you can certainly play mini tennis to work on your skills. Let me back up a second. Maybe not the worst decision. What the worst decision is to make it mandatory, and I've actually heard some different stories saying the sections actually have the choice whether to make the 10 and unders a short court. So I guess I have to find out officially if that's national saying it has to happen or if it's the regional sectional governing bodies.
But, I've never heard that distinction, so that would be new if I've...
Okay, well, I heard that recently. I thought national mandated that 10 and under tennis needed to be played on short courts. Now, if you're trying to get more kids in the game of tennis, I certainly understand playing novice and satellite level tournaments on a short court. But if you're a competitive junior tennis player and you're 9 years old, you can certainly play on a full court. And that what we're seeing actually in Colorado in the 10 and unders is my 9 year olds, they don't want to play on the short court in tournaments.
Exactly right.
They don't want to play. So they don't. And guess what? They go play the 12s and they lose 0-0. And little Johnny is bummed out, and I tell the dad, I'm like, well, he's got to be winning 70% of his matches. But he's not, because he's not going to play the 10 and under. So we will see if this kid knows how to win when he's 14, because he's been losing for 2 or 3 years. I hope it turns out well for him. The other thing is that not giving a player a choice. I think, again, put those short courts on a novice court where kids are learning how to play. But when you're getting into that upper echelon, kids that are really competitive, kids that want to get better, you get them on that full court so that they can just learn what it's about. No reason why they can't practice it, but don't mandate it in tournaments. And I really am aligned with what Wayne Bryan has been talking about for years. He did the same thing with Bob and Mike. I think those guys turned out okay. So I think what the argument is, do we really want to grow the game and get thousands more players involved by playing on a shorter court? Or are we trying to create where that would create a bigger pool to have more tennis champions at the higher echelons, or do we really want to look out for everybody and take care of those players that are excelling?
Yeah, I tend to agree. You didn't grow up with that. Pete didn't grow up with that. Andre didn't grow up with that. I mean, and there's video of Andre Agassi hitting at the age of 7 and 8 with a full racket on a full court, and I think it turned out okay for him. And I've contended for years that there was about a 15 to 20 year span where the problem, and we're seeing the problems with that right now, the problem was nobody made a decent junior racket for kids to get out there and play with, so they were left with playing with a $10 junky junior racket or trying to grab a full-size racket and play, and I think that stunted the growth of a lot of juniors for about a 20-year period. Now I give some credit to Wilson and Prince and a couple other companies that are actually making technology high-tech junior racket that they can get out there and get the feel of a real racket and get the real tennis experience. And I think that using that racket on a full-size court would be the best of both worlds.
And how about this? Play on a full court and just make them play with the green dot ball. I mean, we get the green dot balls with our clinics, and our kids are – these are mid-level players. You know, they're playing tournaments, but they're certainly not national caliber players. But we get the green ball out and they play on a full court. They're not going to play on a mini court. So I would think the USTA would actually look at that, look at the what's going on and say, you know what, let's amend it a little bit. I mean, even some of the tournaments in Colorado, they don't even have tape. They don't even have the lines laid down. So they have to lay tape down on the court, and right. Then the tape comes up off the court in the middle of the matches. It's a debacle. So I think that if you had high-level 10 and unders playing with a green ball, you'd see ridiculous rallies and the ball wouldn't be bouncing over there. So let me be clear. I'm a big proponent of the green dot and the orange balls for skill development at all levels. Even if I need to work on that with a professional player, I'll get those balls out for certain scenarios. But to mandate in tournaments is really defeats the purpose of what actually our country is all about, you know, giving us choice. And we right. should have choice to be able to make coaches and parents and players should be able to make informed decisions that are in the best interest of each player.
And I think a lot of times parents get criticized a lot, but when it comes to their own kids, they know best. And the parents can find coaches like you that'll take the kids on the full size court at that age and have them work the strategy and the points like they should. And I think that's a good thing. And I mean, looking at your game, I mean, you were known to have a pretty big serve when you played. Now it's gotten bigger and bigger. Guys like Raonic and Isner and Karlovic are that's their main shot is the serve. And how glad are you? You don't have to stand on a court right now and stare down a John Isner serve on a high bouncing hard court.
Well, actually, I love the challenge. I mean, certainly it's difficult, sure. But I love the challenge. I played Karlovic in a challenger in Calabasas, California, in the semis or finals. I can't remember the round, but it was actually fun playing him because I wanted to see if I could return it, and I actually felt pretty good returning guys that had serves like that because I felt like I anticipated pretty well and I could read serves pretty well. So I actually enjoyed the challenges, but it does put a lot of pressure on yourself to have to hold serve all the time. Where I got into trouble on the tour is I didn't have the ball striking ability and the ability to play the longer rallies against the Spanish clay court type players. So those types of guys I actually feared more than a guy like Karlovic because I felt like if I could play first strike tennis and really get on his serve and take a couple cuts, I could have a chance at breaking him, you know, once. But like you said, you're probably not going to break him. You hope to get to a tiebreaker and win a couple points. So pick your poison. Play the guy with a huge serve and struggle or play the guy that's been on red clay for 30 years and try to beat him in the first round of a U.S. Open.
Yeah, that's really the great thing about tennis is there is no set script out there on the court. You're just kind of winging it, see what's working, what's not. If something's not working, you change it up. Yeah, you got to go with your strengths, but sometimes you have to improvise, like you said. And we got Wimbledon going on right now. We're talking with Jeff Salzenstein here on the Tech of Sports. And in a few weeks after Wimbledon wraps up, the Olympics are going to be back at Wimbledon again. And how cool is that? We're going to see. Looks like they're going to cover a lot of Olympic tennis this summer because it's at Wimbledon. And how fun is that going to be to watch?
Well, I think it's going to be an incredible spectacle and, you know, another memorable event. And the beginning of the year, I did predictions on my blog. Hold on a second. A little alarm going off there.
That's the USTA calling right there.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think I'll be hired for any high performance jobs anytime soon. I've never been one to really follow the party line. So sorry, guys. I mean, I like Pat Mack and I like the boys there and have good friends, but we got to make adjustment with the 10 under tennis. But back to the Olympics. I mean, what a spectacle. At the beginning of the year in December, I always make my predictions on my blog. I do a three-part prediction video where I kind of say what I think is going to happen in the coming year. And then at the end of the year, we can look at all the mistakes that I made, how many predictions I was wrong on. The one prediction I made, I believe, I'd have to go back just to confirm it, but I picked Roger Federer to win the Olympics. I think for some reason, the Olympics, it being at Wimbledon, I'm just going with him. I don't know why. Maybe it's nostalgia. Maybe I want it for him before he goes out, which, by the way, he's not going to go out anytime soon. This guy can play for another 5 years if he wants. But I'm going to go with Federer to win it, and I think it's going to be an incredible event, of course. And like I said before, we really are at a special time in tennis. We should appreciate these guys because I think Nadal's going to be around for another 4 or 5 years. People were questioning whether he would slow down because of all the running that he does, but he's made adjustments. He's taking the ball earlier, and he has been doing that for a couple of years on certain surfaces. They've scaled back their schedule, so they only play 15 events a year. I think those three guys, they could be around for a while. So if you're 18, 19, 20 years old and you want to be top 10 or top 5 in the world, you better think twice about that in the next 3 to 5 years because those three guys are going to be around for a while and they're obviously going to contend at the Olympics.
If for no other reason than to watch Olympic tennis, I think the reason to watch is they don't have to wear all white for the Olympics. And can you imagine, can you just picture now what Djokovic's going to wear and the Williams sisters are going to break out at Wimbledon now that they don't have to wear the all whites?
Yeah, it's like your parents, you know, saying you can't go out on your curfew is midnight and then all of a sudden for 2 weeks you can stay out all night. It'll be very interesting to see what these guys wear and, you know, what they come up with. So lots of bright colors and probably lots of smiles kind of looking at the Wimbledon officials. Saying, hey, you know, we get to do this for 2 weeks.
I liken it to the kids that went to private school all through grade school and had to wear a uniform, and then they get to high school and they're going to a public high school and they don't have to wear a uniform, and you know how quickly these kids get earrings and they let their hair grow and they're wearing, you know, whatever. It's going to be it's going to be wild.
Yeah, it will be fun stuff.
But just we're going to take a break here for a second, Jeff. You can catch your breath and grab a sip of water, and I'm going to do just a quick break here for Amazon.com, and just to let everybody know, if they're doing any shopping in the coming weeks, coming months on Amazon, you can use the affiliate link here at Netcast Studio. It's netcaststudio.com/Amazon, and there's no extra cost to you to use that affiliate link, and it helps support Netcast Studio and all the variety of programming that we offer. And I always do a pick based on my guest here, Jeff, something that people can buy off of Amazon. And I picked something, since you haven't written a book yet, I picked something that, you know, an old rival of yours wrote. And we're going to go off the map a little bit here and talk about Vince Spadia and his book Breakpoint, The Secret Diary of a Pro Tennis Player. And while
how many people bought Vince's book, by the way?
I did, so I don't know I bought a Kindle version of it, so I don't know how many other people bought it.
You are a true tennis fan.
Well, yeah, you gotta read it. He's an interesting guy.
Yes.
And I was it's a good book. I was expecting him to get a little bit more in depth in the book than he did. He kind of I don't know if he censored himself or the editor censored it a little bit, but it's a good read, and it gives you a little background on a year on the tour with him, and you know, tennis it's 11 months long. The tennis season, it's long. There's, you know, over 70 tournaments that are played each year, every continent. Four different surfaces, indoors, outdoors, and he really gives a good little overview in the book of a year on the tour with him. And if you get nothing else out of the book, you kind of get the book that traveling like he did on the tennis tour, it's not really all that glamorous. So I'm sure you can relate to some of that. And have you read the book, Jeff?
I haven't read the book, but if I'm not mistaken, Dan Markowitz wrote that with him.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm good friends with Dan, and so I actually kind of followed that as he was writing the book. And actually, Vince and I go way back. We first played our first practice set together when we were 10 years old down in Florida. We grew up I think I'm about 10 months older than he is. We played in the juniors together. I was a better junior at 12, but then he was a much better junior from 13 through 18. And then I actually played him in the third round at Kalamazoo at age 18, and he finished second that year to Brian Dunn. So Vince and I have kind of had parallel lives, much different lives, but we've paralleled each other as we've navigated our careers. And, you know, he had a stellar career, lots of highs and a few lows with that losing streak, but he also beat some great players, one of the best two-handed backhands of all time. And a guy that when I played, I didn't really enjoy it because even though I was a lefty, I think that's one of the changes in today's game. The two-handed backhand makes it more difficult for a lefty to exploit. That's what you see with Nadal struggling more with Djokovic, is that his forehand plays into Djokovic's two-handed backhand. And that's exactly what I felt when I played a guy like Vince Spadia or Brian Vahely, who's from your neck of the woods.
Absolutely.
When I hit my wide slice out wide in the ad court, they had those two hands on that racket, which is much different than the one-handers going to the slice. So I actually think that's one reason why you don't see more left-handers at the top of the game anymore. Nadal is an aberration, but outside of Nadal, there aren't a ton of guys that are doing well at the very top of the game. And so, yeah, Vince had a great career and very, I wouldn't say controversial, but he likes to mix it up. He's a rapper and likes to do different things. And I wish him all the best. I think he was great for the game, and I wish him all the best with his post-career stuff, everything that he's doing. But I'm sure it was an interesting read, and I know Dan told me he enjoyed writing that book with Vince and said Vince is a really good guy.
So you can actually say, Vince Spadia, you were afraid of you, huh?
I can't say it the way he can. I'm not the same. I wouldn't characterize myself as a rapper. Like I said, we kind of had different lives going on.
Yeah, he had fun with it, and one other friend of yours and an old doubles partner, I tend sometimes worry about, you know, Justin Gimelstob. Does he come up for air sometimes when he's talking? I worry about you know, either he's going to dislocate his jaw sometimes, or he's going to, you know, not get enough breaths in there when he's on the air. What's your opinion on the job he does?
I love what Justin's doing, and again, it's so nice for me to see what all of my peers are doing after we've completed our pro careers. I've got some great friends that are one guy's in real estate, another guy's coaching, and of course you've got Gimel Staub. Just, I think he's doing an exceptional job for Tennis Channel. He's a young announcer. He's getting more and more reps, and I really think there is a changing of the guard, I believe, in announcing what that you're watching. A guy like Justin, I feel he sees the game very similar to how I see it. When I hear him speak, when I hear him give an analysis of what's really going on out there, I feel like I'm talking sometimes. And that's one of the first times I've ever felt that. Sometimes with the older school announcers, I kind of felt like, no, they're not bending their knees and watching the ball. They're actually doing something very different. And I would hear that from announcers like, you know, he really got low for that shot and different things that I just didn't jive with. And now Justin, I really think he can identify the patterns and what's going on out there. So, you know, he's very charismatic. He can be controversial at times. He's made a few mistakes with things that he's said in the past. But all in all, I think he's one of the best announcers out there. And I believe he's only going to get better.
Yeah, he's getting better. And he does definitely bring something to the sport, a little younger perspective and a little more current perspective. And I think that's good. And you know, getting back to your videos maybe a little bit and working with juniors, can you maybe give a couple, you know, footwork drills? Footwork so important now, getting in the right position to hit these shots. A few footwork drills that maybe juniors can work, can do maybe off the court that you recommend maybe some of your students to do.
Sure. Well, one of my quest or my journey was that I never really had, I would say, world-class coaching at a young age, even in college, although, I mean, I love Coach Gould and Coach Whitlinger, but they weren't really focused on developing me as a professional or teaching me kind of a cutting-edge way to play tennis. I think the Europeans, for a while, and it's shifting a bit, have had the Americans beat with coaching and movement. I know the Spanish are big on movement. So I really had to study the game and experiment. And I started realizing that the way I was moving on a tennis court was not as efficient as I could have been moving. And I learned it from studying the top players with video. And so from that, I developed a series of footwork patterns for every place in the court, whether you're in the middle, whether you're at the baseline in the middle of the court, whether you're moving wide, whether you're on the run, moving forward through the middle part of the court in no man's land, volleys, return footwork. And so there's a lot of footwork patterns out there that these pros are doing both naturally and also taught. I believe some of these guys have been taught this way to move and others do it a little bit more naturally. But for us mere mortals, we've got to start somewhere with how to move more gracefully around the court. So what I've noticed is that a lot of coaches talk about just moving your feet, and I've tried to take it a step further. Instead of moving your feet, I like to teach people how to move the feet. So as far as footwork drills go, I think shadow stroking the right footwork patterns without a tennis ball is one of the most powerful things you can ever do. Now you might ask the question, well, what footwork patterns am I supposed to do? Well, of course, that's a nice segue to saying, hey, just check out my blog at jeffsalzensteintennis.com because we have over 115 videos on that blog now. We have the same on YouTube, and there's a lot of footwork patterns in there. So there's a great opportunity for people to check out my site and kind of get to know what I teach with the footwork patterns. And then again, once you see how to move in a certain place of the court, go out on a court and shadow stroke it. I was doing that at 29, 30 years old. I would go out to a public court and actually do my form of Tai Chi tennis and move in a way that I could really focus on my feet instead of hitting a tennis ball and the result of what might happen, whether the ball was going to go in or whether the ball was going to go out or whether I was going to win the point or lose the point. So footwork is key, and learning how to dance on the court is very, very important.
Yeah, JeffSalzensteinTennis.com is your place to go for that. And tell listeners and viewers, Jeff, how they can maybe follow you on Twitter and maybe contact you if they have questions, if they have maybe a top junior player that maybe they want to get some guidance on, and how can they get a hold of you, and where else can they see what you're all about on the internet?
Sure. Well, on the internet, we started a couple years ago. We've been doing it for about a year and a half. We actually launched our first course called the Tennis Forehand Solution last August. It was a wild success. It did really, really well, and people love it. We're giving the fundamentals on the forehand, and what's really cool is we're teaching people how to play tennis virtually. You know, you couldn't do this 10, 15 years ago, and now the wild world has opened up with the internet, as you guys know, and people can actually watch a two-minute video. They can download it on their iPhone or their iPod or their iPad or whatever Android device they have, and they can take it on the court with them, and it's really helped them improve. We also have a membership site that people, if they want to dig deeper besides the free content we have, they can do that as well. So we have plenty to offer. We have a huge launch coming up actually next month. I'm not going to reveal what it is. It's going to be a big secret, but you're going to want to check that out if you become a subscriber, a free subscriber at my blog. And there's plenty of free material there. I'm trying to provide as much value as possible. And if anyone wants to get in contact with me, we get emails from all over the world. We've got 25 countries represented in our membership site. And our subscriber base, our community is growing. And it's really, really exciting. If people want to get hold of me, they can just go to my blog. And I believe there's a contact tab right at the top in the navigation. They can send an email that way and we'll get it. They can find me at Twitter at Jeff Salzenstein. There's no space there. And I've got a Facebook fan page, Jeff Salzenstein Tennis, facebook.com/Jeff Salzenstein Tennis. And then I think there's a link underneath this video where I'm giving away, for everyone's listening today, I'm giving away some free forehand videos. So if you want to learn about some of the myths that maybe your coach is telling you that you don't want to do, check it out. And just really looking forward to building our tennis community. And ultimately, we want to reach as many tennis players as possible and make a difference. And I'm just trying to give them a behind-the-scenes look of what it's like, what it was like as a pro player, and also now as a high-performance coach, really trying to make a difference.
I may have to check that out, Jeff. I have a few media tournaments coming up, so I may have to check that forehand out. I don't want to lose to anyone this summer. So I don't call your JeffSalzensteinTennis.com. I don't even call that a website. I call that more of a resource. And with all that's available on there, so it's really worthwhile checking out. And you give a good overview of what's on there. And another question here before we kind of wrap up a little bit. For people that go out and watch live professional tennis, it's a little different than what they see on TV. And depending on where you're sitting in the stands, you kind of have a different perspective. But they haven't really done a lot other than adding the Hawkeye in, where they can kind of, the fans kind of clap the hands and get behind, you know, whatever player they want and look for, to see if that ball was in or out. What else can be done to maybe improve the live tennis viewing experience that hasn't been tried already?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know what you can do. I mean, on TV, it does look like ping pong. I mean, it looks like they're hitting the ball back and forth. And until you see it live, you don't have an appreciation for the athleticism and the speed, the shot selection, the physical endurance. You know, I mean, you get a snapshot of it on TV, but live is a whole different deal. So if anybody listening out there has never been to a professional tournament, I highly recommend you get to one, try to get to a Grand Slam. It will change your perspective of how difficult this sport is to play. I think it is the most difficult sport to play for many different reasons. And so I really don't know if I can answer that question, Rick, on how to improve it on TV. I mean, it's just, it is what it is. It's one-on-one, and I don't know how you capture that speed. Maybe you could do more virtual cameras, you know, in different angles and zooming in and zooming out, but I don't really know how you capture that. It's a difficult one, but like I said, our sport is on the rise, and some great things are happening with it, and we just got to keep those big three around as long as possible, and we've got to get a couple Americans up there, and I don't
Absolutely.
Know if that's going to happen, but we really do. It would help if we had a top American up there in the next 5 to 10 years, so hopefully a guy like Ryan Harrison can bust through, or some others that are on the rise.
Yeah, and I'm not going to mention any names, but there's a lefty that's based here in Atlanta that's struggling a little right now that could use help from probably a guy like you. And you probably won't get the call, but there's a lot of talent going to waste there, and it pains me to see what's kind of going on. And he's not a bad guy, he could be a big hope for American tennis. And we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, when I watch some of the guys struggle out there, of course, you know, it's easy to be an armchair quarterback and say, well, I would do this or I would do that. But ironically enough, I live in Denver, Colorado, not exactly a tennis hotbed. I'm not really going to get pros showing up in Denver unless I was living in Miami or Atlanta. But I think that actually one of the things that would be my strength would be to work with a player like that and to really make a difference. But, you know, you need a special type of player that's going to buy into what you're going to want to do. I've coached a couple of pro players, a couple of on the women's side, and I didn't get the buy-in. And that's a challenge for a coach, because you really, for me, I have my best interests involved with the player. And so unless you get the buy-in and you can cut out all the extra crap that's going on, you really can't get the work done as a coach. So I hope that in some of the different situations with the American players out there, we can see them cut away the baggage and really make the most of it.
Yeah, and you said you were going to be kind of scared by this last question, but it's a question I ask all my guests. And you, even though you're a Stanford guy, you say you're not a technology guy, and I think you're underestimating yourself a little bit. But what's the what would you say is the one piece of modern technology that maybe you can't live without, either in your personal life now as a retired player and a coach, or your professional life?
The technology I can't live without. Yeah. I have to name one thing.
Yeah, and I mean, not your refrigerator or your microwave or something like that, but, you know, is it that phone that keeps going off there? Is that something
you... Yeah, you know, for some reason, I've got that alarm set at 5:30, and I forgot to turn it off, and it's on snooze, but I assure you I'm not sleeping at 5:30, but, yeah, the cell phone and the computer, both. I mean, you know, I'm on this thing a lot now, trying to build this company online and to really share the tennis throughout the world, so without a computer and without a cell phone, you're pretty hamstrung, and you wonder what you did 15, 20 years ago without these things, but time is moving faster, things are moving faster, you got to get things done faster. I've got people helping me all over the world with my websites, and so yep. You know, I'm on Skype in the middle of the night sometimes with people, so the computer and the phone, they're tied for first.
Okay, that's fair enough, and I think you're right on that. It's not some souped-up ball machine, I guess, that you're out there drilling those kids with. So pretty much typical. Usually people say their tablet or their computer or their iPhone. So good answer. But as we wrap up, tell the viewers and listeners one more time how they can see what everything you have going on and how they can get in touch with you and follow you.
Easiest place to get started is to go to jeffsalzenstein.com. I'm sorry, jeffsalzensteintennis.com. Yep. I know it's a mouthful, but... hopefully after a couple years, people will be able to spell my name like Bolitari. But that's the place to go, because there's a lot of free content there. And that's for you to get to know me, to see what I'm all about, to see if you think I know what I'm talking about. And then, of course, underneath this video, I believe we have a hyperlink you can click on to get some video tips on the forehand. And so if you have a forehand and you want to improve it, check those clips out. And then once you become a subscriber, become a part of our free community at Jeff Salzenstein Tennis, I assure you, you'll be getting emails from me. I'm not shy. You'll probably get 3 emails a week. So if you don't want a lot of tennis emails every week, you probably shouldn't subscribe. But if you're interested in really good information, good stories about the past and the tour and tennis tips, and you want to improve your game, I think I'm your guy.
Definitely. I have to say you are, and I must have missed that link, because I'm going to subscribe to your newsletter, and maybe you can help me through some of those media tournaments this summer. So I really appreciate it, Jeff. It was sure. It was great having you on.
Pleasure being with you all, and bring me back anytime. I love talking tennis, and I'll talk about other stuff too if you need a guest.
We'll definitely have you on, and I had a blast with that, and just want to let everybody know the Netcast Studio has many other shows which may be of interest to you, and you can head over to netcaststudio.com and check out all the shows besides The Tech of Sports. And I just want to let everyone know that you've been listening to The Tech of Sports tonight, Tech of Sports podcast, a Netcast Studio production.